Welcome to Consilience, an African science podcast, brought to you from Johannesburg, South Africa. Consilience is a weekly podcast dedicated to promoting reason, skepticism, and a scientific worldview in Africa and beyond.
Welcome to Consilience. Today is August 29th, 2011, and I'm Owen Swart. Joining me today are Michael Meaden.
Good evening.
And Angela Meaden.
Good evening.
All right, let's get started with teaching Angela to appreciate history.
Okay, so teaching Angela to appreciate history, one of us, usually me.
That's because you know so much about history.
Not really.
You're the history guy, Mike.
No, I'm not. Anyway, in teaching Angela to appreciate history, one of us, usually me, attempts to turn Angela into less of a Philistine when it comes to all matters historical and to make her appreciate the finer points of the history of science. So, on... Why are you frowning?
Because I don't have an issue with the history of science. It's the history of everything else that bores me.
Okay, so on the Ides of March, 44 BC, Julius Caesar was stabbed to death by a gaggle of, what is the collective noun for Roman senators? Like a...
Argue?
A debate.
A forum post.
A forum of Roman senators.
Okay, so a forum of Roman senators.
Forum.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I said. What is the Torah thing they used to wear?
Toga.
Toga. A toga of Roman senators.
Nice.
Mm. Very good.
A Torah. They should have called it a Torah. Yeah. Anyway, we're getting totally off track.
But was there science history here somewhere? Something?
What? Okay. So we're teaching Angela to appreciate history. And on either August 30th or 31st, in 1909, a man by the name of Charles Doolittle Walcott discovered the Burgess Shales.
Ah, the Burgess Shale. I've heard about those.
Sure. This is one of the most famous paleontological sites in history, quite probably mostly because of the book by Stephen Jay Gould called Wonderful Life, which he published in 1989 and became something of a bestseller. And the Burgess Shale is just basically a fossil bed that consists of middle or early Cambrian posits, or early animals exhibiting very interesting and diverse body plans, were preserved in exquisite detail. And this is where you've probably heard of the concept of the Cambrian explosion, and that's where this comes from. It stems from this discovery that in a geological blink of an eye, probably in a couple of million years, we now know that's probably a bit longer, a whole bunch of evolutionary radiation or diversification took place in geologically extremely fast period of time, and a lot of these very interesting critters were preserved in this Burgess Shale, which Charles Walcott studied, and he went to the site every year for, I think, 7 or 8 seasons or something like that until his death, and he found all sorts of really, really very interesting creatures.
I just would like to hazard a guess that perhaps the site is famous because of the archaeological, well, because of the fossils and not because Stephen Jay Gould wrote about it.
Well, it wasn't in the public domain famous before the book, as far as I know. So it was known about by paleontologists and was famous among paleontologists because of its fossils. But the general public itself didn't know about it until Stephen Jay Gould wrote about it. And it's sort of an interestingly controversial book because Gould, as many of you know, is not exactly the most reliable guide when it comes to evolutionary science for various reasons. I like and respect him in many ways, but he had sort of weird ideas and he was, he's a Marxist and he had very deeply held ideological convictions, which he often allowed to color his view of the science, which I think everybody does, but Gould was guilty in several rather egregious cases, like in the sociobiology controversy of the 1980s, of letting his emotions get in the way of a sober analysis of the facts. And in this case, something similar seems to have happened. His findings were, or at least his argument in Wonderful Life, was very strongly contested by Simon Conway Morris, who was actually one of the scientists involved in the reinterpretation of the British shale fossils that took place from the 1960s onwards. So there's I'll link in the show notes to an interesting exchange between Conway Morris and Gould, published, I think, about a decade after Gould's book was published, so it's about 1999 or so.
Shall we move on to the news?
Yes, let's move on to the news. And first, this week, we are looking at Comet Elenin.
Yeah, so what do you know about Comet 2010X1 Elenin?
I only know what Chris Sham told me last week.
Comet Elenin is a long-period comet that originates from the Oort cloud at the edges of our solar system.
It's the Oort cloud?
The Oort cloud is a group of cold, icy, rocky blobs of interstellar things.
That the asteroids.
Asteroids and comets.
Not to get technical or anything.
But some people also say that Pluto is part of the Oort cloud.
No, that's the Kuiper Belt, which is inside the Oort cloud. The Oort cloud is largely theoretical at this point. We haven't directly observed it, but there are lots of objects that we see coming into the inner solar system from time to time that we imagine probably come from the Oort cloud. So we can infer its existence from these objects, like Comet Elenin.
And they have sort of similar characteristics. So Comet Elenin has an orbital period of about 10,000 years. And as far as we know, this is its first approach towards the sun.
Nice.
Yeah. Elenin is slated to reach its closest point to the sun in...
December 21st, 2012.
No, definitely not. But you bring up a good point, Mike. Lots of people have been linking Elenin to the 2012 doomsday predictions. And some crazy internet conspiracy theorists have postulated that Nibiru is sort of it's a moon of a brown dwarf that they call Nibiru. So it's kind of like this very fuzzy conspiratorial thinking.
Mm. What are the chances that a comet appears in the same year that some crazy people think the world will end? Surely very low.
Pretty high, actually, because they've actually discovered dozens of comets in the past 2 years, of which 2010X1 Elenin is just one of them. So let me give you a few more details. Specifically about the conspiracies, because I find this stuff really funny. Some people believe in something called the electric universe, which I had described to me today.
Oh, this is good. All right, so the electric universe is one of these crazy alternate unifying theories of the universe, which basically postulates that the only force in the universe is electricity. That gravity and the strong and weak nuclear forces and these sorts of things don't exist.
Which, of course, just goes against our entire understanding of physics.
Right, exactly. I mean, we can easily show that this is wrong.
The standard model of physics, the only unifying force are boobies.
Yes, of course. Everybody knows that.
Are simultaneously a standard divisive force.
Nice. Yes, that's true.
Okay.
It's the dual nature of boobies.
Quantum.
Quantum boobies. Nice. All right, so among the various crazy things about the electric universe theory, one of the ideas that they put forward is that whenever two large bodies come close to each other, they will exchange large amounts of electrons between them. So if an asteroid or a comet were to fly close enough to the Earth, there would be massive lightning bolts between the surfaces of these two objects exchanging these electrons.
Sounds incredible.
It does.
And it is.
Yes, it is.
Incredible.
Completely.
So some conspiracy theorists online claim that this comet Elenin has been collecting electrons in outer space and has built up a huge charge, which it will release at perigee, which is its closest point to the sun. And this moment of electrical exchange is said to be what's going to be like the end of the world, because there's going to be all these electrons like flying around, and it's just going to be mass earthquakes.
No.
Yeah. So one particular website that I found claims that the electromagnetism lubricates fault lines in the Earth. and that this will cause earthquakes because there'll be fault slippage.
Lubricates fault lines.
Yes. Well, I mean, don't you remember we've had the Japan earthquakes this year? True. We had some Northeast American earthquakes earlier in this month.
Well, everybody knows that electrons are very slippery. So it only makes sense.
Yes, of course. I mean, needless to say, this is all rubbish. Elenin is just a comet. It's a long-period comet. It's remarkably unremarkable at this point. It's barely visible. It's just a teeny tiny little smudge. And all of the theories that it's going to herald the end of Earth, or basically pulled out of somebody's butt.
Right.
Well,
nice.
Well, they can pull it out of the butt if it's lubricated with enough electrons. So how close does this thing actually get to the sun?
Its closest approach to Earth will be about 2.3 astronomical units away from us.
So that's far.
Yeah, that's
so that's
far, yeah.
Like 100 times as far away as the moon. I don't have the figures for its closest approach to the sun.
So why, if these bodies always exchange these electrical discharges, doesn't the moon do that?
Yeah.
Suppose it didn't collect it in
because
outer space.
Exactly, it hasn't been collecting them in outer space.
Because there are plenty of electrons in deep space, right?
Yeah. I've got a better question. Why, if these exchanges of electrons happen all the time whenever two large bodies come close to each other, why does that never happen?
Don't be so logical.
Sorry.
You and your logic. Yeah. Look, I mean, we have been approached by far larger comets, and they have come far closer to us. So there's just really no scientific precedent for any of the claims that are made regarding Edenin's supposed electron exchange and all of that stuff. It's made up out of whole cloth.
And surely if these comets were capable of it, Shoemaker Levy 9 in, 1994 or so, when it smacked into Jupiter, we would have observed this electrical discharge taking place.
Absolutely. Right? And we would observe with Halley's comet that goes past. And,
sure.
You know, we would observe it with a lot of comets, but it's a conspiracy theory. It's not based on truth. It's not based on science. It's based on being slightly crazy and just inventing stuff and seeing tiny correlations in a lot of data.
As I understand it, the basis for this theory dates back to pre-Einsteinian model of the universe, where people were still trying to figure out how things fit together and that kind of stuff. And it was thoroughly discredited back then, sort of a century or so ago. Mm. But for some reason, some people have latched onto it and held onto it.
So it might have been science 100 years ago. It was discredited. Scientists moved on. And now for some reason, some cranks have latched onto it. I mean, why?
I'm not sure if he had even qualified as science back then. I think it might have been the 19th century equivalent of string theory today. It's kind of speculative, almost science.
The reason we're discussing Edenin is that just this week, observations have pointed to the enticing possibility that Edenin might be disintegrating.
Nice.
Yep. Didn't see that coming when you said it was the harbinger of doom, did you?
But what's this going to do to the fleet of UFOs that are flying in its tail?
Well, then they're just
hiding them.
Maybe they blew it up to mask their approach.
That would make sense. So amateur astronomers have been tracking Edenin since its discovery, because basically at this point it's so far away and so dim that it doesn't make sense for the big telescopes to be looking at it. So this week some Australian amateur astronomers took photographs of it, which show that Edenin's coma, which is like the large diffuse cloud of gas and dust that evaporates off of the comet as it approaches the sun, it suddenly disappeared. It got much, much dimmer than it was. And this coincides with the coronal mass ejection. And it looks as though the coronal mass ejection has had a serious effect on Edenin, which is now decreasing in brightness. And the coma is elongating and becoming very much more diffuse than it was before. So it's like it's about as dense as it's less dense than the best vacuum we can make on Earth.
Wow.
The coma might reappear after a while, but previous comets which have been observed to behave in this way usually break up and don't survive perigee. So they just don't survive going around the sun. It's too hot. They just break up.
That's pretty awesome.
So it's not so remarkably unremarkable then, if it's showing signs of breaking up.
Well, it's just it's fun to watch.
Even that is not common. So remarkable. Okay. It's not common, but it does happen, and we have observed it before. And yeah, I do have a quote for the conspiracy theorists out there by Dr. David Morrison. He's a senior scientist at NASA. And he says that, by definition, a comet is a small object that sheds an extensive thin atmosphere of gas as it approaches the sun. If it were massive, such as a planet, brown dwarf, or black hole, its gravity would hold onto the gas and it could not develop a coma or a tail. So because we see a coma and a tail around Edenin, we know it's just a comet.
Nice.
Yeah, but it could be exhaust fumes from its rocket engine. Of the UFO.
That's true. That's possible. Mm-hmm.
Sure. And the squirrels with their spokes. Could have played a part. This is just part of the liberal conspiracy to keep true white Americans down.
That's true.
one of you guys asked earlier what would happen to the alien spaceships hiding in the tail.
Right.
We still wouldn't be able to see them, because even if the comet does disintegrate, it's still going to follow Newtonian physics and sort of continue orbiting in its path. That mass of gas and ice will still move sort of like it's moving now, although it will drift apart over time.
Mission accomplished.
Gravity, yep. It's not only a good idea, it's the law.
I do like that. Okay, shall we move on to penises?
Yes, let's move on to penises. Yes, well, here we have a story about penises, and this one comes to us from James Hoff. The Johannesburg Metropolitan Police Force on Friday arrested a Ugandan man here in Joburg named Frank Mukasi, who also calls himself Prophet Hamza.
Oh, okay.
All right, so now Mr. Mukasi, along with dozens of similar quacks, makes a habit of distributing flyers and posters around Joburg and other cities around South Africa, advertising their services as a doctor, in scare quotes, specializing particularly in ailments of the penis. So things like erectile dysfunction and not getting laid enough. And
yeah, you basically can't drive down a road in Joburg without seeing every second street pole plastered with a penis enlargement cream poster.
Right, exactly.
Wow, God, what a city we live in.
Ah, Joburg. All right, so it almost goes without saying that Mukasi is not a doctor, and he has no medical qualifications. His treatments consist of traditional medicine, as it's called here, or more commonly known as muti, and they are not based on any scientifically verifiable interventions, right? So he's just picking some herbs and mixing it into a paste and then selling it to people to rub on their penises.
Although, I mean, sometimes herbal remedies do have at least, I wouldn't say scientific evidence. Sometimes those get developed, but sometimes there's a long tradition of use of certain herbs for certain ailments, and those tend to be at least very preliminary evidence of efficacy.
Like the bark of the cinchona tree for prevention of malaria.
That's right.
Oh, and also, there was something with Hanuman, that wasn't it?
Yes, he was the man who invented the pseudoscience of homeopathy because he somehow ingested some of this bark and it gave him an allergic reaction. And he decided that his allergic reaction was similar to malaria. Therefore, it's rather like coincidental.
Yeah.
But yes, it's
serendipity, I think.
It's serendipity of a sort that led to a crazy pseudoscience. But let's get back on track. It's other crazy pseudoscience.
Yes, let's talk about penises some more. All right, so although it's not inconceivable that Mukasi and his ilk's treatments may have some undocumented form of efficacy, as far as we're concerned, that his products haven't been scientifically verifiably tested, and that they haven't been approved by any sort of medicines council or anything like that, as is the case of most muti.
And we're not the only people who have that opinion. The South African doctors, what was it, the Young Doctors Association?
Yeah, the Junior Doctors Association of South Africa and the South African Medical Association issued a joint statement saying pretty much words to that effect. All right, but now the interesting thing here to the story is that Mukasi wasn't arrested for impersonating a doctor, as you might imagine he would be, because it seems that that's not really a crime in South Africa. In fact, he was arrested for damage to public property for sticking up his posters.
Okay.
So, although the Junior Doctors Association and the Medical Association have issued a statement resoundingly supporting his arrest, it's not really helping our cause much, because he wasn't arrested for the right reasons.
So basically, he was putting up posters on buildings?
Yeah, on public property, yeah.
And without authorization?
Yes, yeah, and costing taxpayer money to have the posters removed because it was a nuisance.
Well, I mean, it is a nuisance, and he does. There are a lot of posters there, but it's not just him. It's a lot of other guys, and perhaps this serves as a bit of a deterrent, but I'm not even so sure in this city that that's going to have anything.
Right, exactly.
But the problem is, if he makes money from the posters, then he makes money to pay to have the posters put up legally, and then he doesn't get prosecuted or prevented from being a fake.
Except that he is making false claims, which we can then challenge according to the CPA.
Yeah, the new Consumer Protection Act gives us a new weapon to use against these guys, but that hasn't been the instrument, the legal instrument used here.
And these guys, they're so easy to track down. Their phone numbers and their names and their addresses are on these flyers and these posters. Why aren't we doing something, guys?
Yeah, well, that's the question that the two associations were asking. You know, why isn't this happening? Why aren't we arresting these guys for being fraudulent?
Because it's politically incorrect, because you're imposing a Western ideology on an African culture. I think that would be one of the gut reactions that people have.
Right, exactly.
Which, of course, is nonsense because the scientific method is culturalist, although it did develop originally in Western Europe in the 17th century. African cultures made vast and important contributions to it and to its development. And Africans, at least some Africans, are at the forefront of science today. So
exactly, as we spoke about last week with the square kilometer array. Built by Africans for Africans.
African solutions to astronomical problems.
Exactly. All right, so although it's kind of cool that one of these idiots has been taken off the streets, there's plenty more where he came from, and really this doesn't seem to be a step in the right direction at all, because we're not yet using the right tool to get these guys sorted out.
Was he prosecuted yet, or was he just arrested and charged?
I believe he's just been arrested and charged. Right. But we'll keep an eye on the story and see if we can come up with any updates that are of value.
Cool.
Alrighty.
Alright, shall we move on to a planet made of diamond?
Yeah. A team led by Matthew Bales of Swinburne University of Technology in Melbourne detected a pulsar in December of 2009 using the Parkes radio telescope. Follow-up observations of this pulsar showed periodic changes in brightness.
What's a pulsar?
A pulsar is a rapid spinning star that has reached the end of its lifespan and it's contracted and spins really, really fast, and it sort of flashes like a lighthouse set to turbo. It goes round and round and round and goes pulse, 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 and sort of would mean.
And of course, the light comes out in two beams.
Yes.
And sometimes those beams are aimed at us, and that's where we can see them flashing like a lighthouse.
There you go.
And that's also why we thought they were aliens.
Are you happy?
Because they're also among the most regular natural phenomenon that we know of.
Yes, it is, yeah, because they have an incredibly regular pulse, which is why when follow-up observations showed periodic changes in the brightness of pulse, we knew that there was a planet orbiting this pulsar.
Ah.
Exactly which
pulsar. Planet orbiting a pulsar. Awesome.
Nice.
Oh, sun was a pulsar. That would have been so much more interesting. We'd be dead.
Probably.
So, this particular pulsar, known as PSR J1719-1438, is one of only a handful of pulsars are known to have planets.
Wow.
Before the discovery of this particular pulsar, we knew of two which had planets out of the 1,800 we have observed.
And no one phoned me to tell me this. Like, the astronomical community has not done its survey. Yeah. Someone should have, from the World Astronomy Society of World...
NASA should have phoned me.
Yeah, the head of fucking NASA should have phoned me.
I should have.
Said, Michael, there's like a pulsar dude and it has a planet.
They should have
been like hectic.
They seriously dropped the ball here.
You are not high enough on the list. High up enough on the list.
High enough?
I just like, in my head, I just edited that sentence out. You're not high enough up on the list.
Damn.
Sorry. This planet is... It has approximately the same mass as Jupiter, and it orbits at around 600,000 kilometers from the pulsar.
That's damn close.
It's extremely close.
That's inside the orbit of Mercury, isn't it?
Far inside.
It's only about 1.5 times as far away from its sun as the moon is from Earth.
Holy crap.
It's really, really, really close. The pulsar's gravity should tear it apart.
In theory.
If it was a gas giant, which... up until now, we would assume it was because of its mass, it would be within this like danger zone where the pulsar would tear it apart and steal its atmosphere. So because it hasn't lost all of its mass, we've got to assume that it's less than 60,000 kilometers in diameter. So really, really small and compact, much smaller than Jupiter.
All right, whereas the tidal forces would tear it to shreds, right? So it has to be small, and it probably has to be solid if it's that small.
Correct.
And that massive.
Pulsars are thought to achieve their rapid spin by stripping mass from a companion star. So the core of a stripped-down star would be mostly carbon, like a dash of oxygen, with about the mass of Jupiter. And such an object would be under high pressure because of its own gravity. This would cause it to crystallize, most likely into diamond, just as carbon does deep down inside the Earth. So this is how we think that this object orbiting this pulsar is made of diamond.
And with this, we will see the launch of a new interplanetary space program sponsored by De Beers.
Yes, bring it back.
With
okay, so there you go. We have a diamond planet, possibly.
That's freaking cool.
That is just preposterously awesome. I mean, I've heard about these massive diamonds before, but still, this is really cool if it actually pans out. We've made no, as far as I can tell from the story, made no direct observations to confirm it's a diamond, right? So it's just, given the physics of the situation, we have to assume it's probably made of this, and it can only have this diameter, therefore it has to be a diamond thing.
Correct. We are inferring from what we understand of how these kinds of systems evolve and develop and behave that it's probably made of the same stuff as diamond.
Nice.
And if you put it on a ring, you won't be able to stand up.
You would get laid.
Oh, God. Okay, over to Michael for his surprise news article.
Yay.
Okay, so our final news story for the day is rather bad news.
Oh, no.
You would have heard about the James Webb telescope before, and it is the successor to Hubble.
Mm-hmm.
Now, although Webb is going to be, hopefully, and I use this word advisedly, going to be, hopefully, an infrared telescope, so it's not really a direct successor to the optical Hubble, but it's still the sort of the spiritual successor to Hubble. And we all know and love Hubble.
Right.
And James Webb is just bigger and better. It has a bigger mirror and so on. But it has run into rather serious problems. According to an article in Science magazine, the Webb telescope has now been delayed by 2 further years.
Oh, geez.
Until 2018.
What?
Holy crap. And in addition, its costs have risen by $1.5 billion to now a total of $8 billion.
Wow.
How did that happen? Somebody has got to stop ordering hors d'oeuvres. Seriously.
Well, I think a lot of it, at least according to at least some people, it's always hard to tell when you're on the outside. I think the only people who really know, and they probably don't even know the whole story, are the people who sit on the inside. But apparently there has been some serious mismanagement and also chronic underfunding. So in a sense, they're spending too little money on a yearly basis, and as a result of that, it's taking longer and actually costing more overall.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Right. Now, to put this in perspective, NASA only has a budget of around about $17 billion US dollars anyway.
So that's a substantial portion of their budget.
Sure. And this price tag has now risen to this $8 billion, and it's already been delayed from 2014 to 2015, and now probably to 2018. And
this is very bad news.
And the other bit of bad news is that a House committee has already voted to cut Webb's funding. Now, of course, this House committee first has to deal with the Senate and so on, but this was quite big a while back, and there was an uproar in the scientific community. And it didn't look like that was going to go through. But because of this latest budget overrun, now the knives are quite probably going to be out for this telescope once again, because it's costing $1.5 billion more dollars. And it's hard to argue that this mission is too far along to cancel now, because it's still so far off.
You know,
they've been building this thing for half a decade, and they're not even halfway.
It's not as if they have a completed telescope sitting on a launch pad. Far from it.
We really need to stop spending money on killing each other, and we need to start investing it in more profitable enterprise, such as human knowledge. Seriously, stop killing each other.
Well, I think it's just the tricky bit with just stop killing each other is that the other side, as it were, is not going to stop.
You know, we need fewer people.
Yeah, and bigger bombs.
Bigger bombs, fewer people will be there.
So let's hold thumbs that this telescope does not get cancelled because of this cost overrun. Big projects like this, especially government-run ones, which aren't known for their overwhelming sense of efficiency, tend to go over cost and take longer. They always do. But this is still going to be an awesome instrument. 6.5-meter telescope, well, 6.5-meter mirror up in space, looking at some of the oldest objects ever observed, or probably will find the oldest objects ever observed, and will contribute probably as much as Hubble has. So another $1.5 billion sounds like a lot of money, but in the overall perspective of the U.S. budget, really isn't. Not that I have a say, given that I don't pay U.S. taxes, but seriously, guys, what extra $1.5 billion is worth it for what the human race as a whole and Americans in particular will get out of this instrument?
Especially for a country with a $700 billion defense budget, military budget. Okay, so there you go.
All right, let's move into something a little uplifting. That is our feature this week, and that is an interview with the lovely Bianca Verlinden.
Hi, I'm Carl Zimmer from The Loom, and you're listening to Consilience.
Joining us now is Bianca Verlinden, who is a PhD candidate at the University of Pretoria, and she's doing her research on, she'll tell us herself, but basically saving Africa and the world from the terrible scourge of malaria, which in fact kills more people than HIV and AIDS. Is that right?
That's right. My PhD work is about finding new antimalarial agents. And now we specifically look at DNA replication. And one molecule that's very important in replication is polyamines. And we look at things that inhibit polyamines. So we would take, for instance, I'm coming from a genetic engineering background. We will take E. coli and we'll transform it with one of the parasites genes, the Plasmodium parasites genes, and we will it will basically expose it to the compounds that we're testing, and we'll see that it has an activity on that particular enzyme. So we can see whether or not it's being effective. That's just one area of the PhD sort of the scope.
Do you have any promising leads? Do you think you're going to make some good progress? Do you think good progress is possible with this line of research? Obviously, you do.
Absolutely. We've got an accepted publication at the Journal of Medicinal Chemistry, and usually antimalarial agents, the MMV, which is the Malaria Medicine Venture, anything that has that is effective against the parasites below 1 micromolar is considered valuable. And ours is sitting currently at about it's in the nanomolar range, 88 nanomolar. So it's highly effective. And an important question to answer is selectivity. A lot of the antimalarial work, it kills the parasite, but it kills every other human cell as well. And that's, we look specifically at selectivity index. And what we've seen, if you want to do animal studies, for instance, your selectivity index has to be above 10 to go into animals and above 100 to go into humans. And ours is particularly sitting at 7,000. So it's incredibly selective. And so a lot of potential.
But it's still obviously preclinical.
Preclinical, absolutely. So it's going into animal studies, and once it actually finishes that, we hand over to the MMV, and they continue the study. They're far more well equipped than the smaller industries and university studies.
Bianca, we've got you in our claws tonight because we came to a public talk at SciBono looking at sort of genetically modified organisms and whether or not they're harmful or helpful. Would you like to maybe just give us a little bit of background information on your talk?
Yes, the talks is, are genetically modified organisms, are they harmful or helpful? And in my research, what I've realized is that defining a GMO as harmful or helpful is actually the easy part. The problem comes in when you find one particular GMO that appears to be both. It says harmful, it is helpful. And we need to ask our question, the question, do the risks outweigh the benefits? And that's what the talk was really focusing on, and trying to take a neutral approach and presenting both arguments and really just expand the audience's mind on it and then to let them decide. Quite interesting, we were talking about earlier, we were saying like the first image that comes into your mind when you think of a GMO. And if you can think about when you hear the words GMO, what's the first thing that comes to your mind? And some people, said crops, some people said cloning. And one distinction I want to make that genetic modification isn't so much cloning. Like cloning is when you take one cell and you make an identical cell, an identical copy. Whereas genetic modification is trying to actually either improve the genetic material. You're adding a gene so that you can have an improved characteristic.
Our listeners will know that we've spoken about genetically modified organisms before, but now that we have an expert in front of us, perhaps you could explain to us the difference between GMOs and hybridized crops.
GMOs, sorry, we mean, for instance, like selective breeding. All right, now, I would always have to go back to the father of, for instance, Green Evolution, and he was he had his PhD in plant pathology, and he was basically, he was a selective breeder. Now, the way I see it, nature naturally evolves and chooses the best crops to take it forward to the subsequent generations, and I think it's just sort of speeding up nature's process where you see, okay, my example was of Norman Barlow, where he took hybridization, he had a plant that was producing grains on the top of the wheat plants, and he didn't, through process of breeding, the whole plant became full of grains that you could actually, that the people, you can basically use that whole plant, and that it was actually getting so heavy that it would fall over. So you would take that plant and breed it with a plant that, for instance, has a dwarf stem, and it's got the stem is a lot stronger, so therefore you can have a plant that doesn't fall over and then pests eat it. So he was responsible for saving over 1 billion people's lives by doing that, that artificial selection, if I can put it. And he was hugely in favor of genetically modified crops. Because that's just I think, the next step, if I can put it like that, where you're looking for specific traits now that you want, and you can actually go into the cell and, you know, you take the gene and you put it into the gene of interest and you give the plant the characteristic you want. It's just skipping a couple of steps. But yeah, Norman Barlow said that anyone who is against GMOs has never produced a kilogram of food in their life, because you have no idea how hard it is.
A point we've made a few times is that, especially on previous episodes of the podcast, is that people sometimes get an idea in their heads that GMO is going to be taking two wildly different species and, like, putting the glow-in-the-dark ability of a squid into your wheat. And can you maybe give us personally, I don't think that that's what's happening. Could you give us a little bit more information?
Awesome, though.
If it's talking about glowing things, the first GMO pet that was released was a glowfish. They put a green fluorescent protein into one of the fishes and it's glowing. And that's, well, it's some people, you know, find that kind of thing fascinating. But I think I'm coming from the perspective that, from an educational viewpoint, where what you're doing should be beneficial. So the best thing I can think to tell you is that the Asilomar Conference in 1975, that's when GMO research really kicked off, and the government basically said that we don't want you putting sheep genes into monkeys and things like that, because that's not what it's about. This technology, you know, can cause a lot of harm if it lands in the wrong hands. And it was agreed that all research would be overseen by the government. And I think they'd really had a good clampdown on it. And because starting out with that technology, it was so strict and the regulation was so strict, it never did get that out of hand. But who knows what NGOs are doing? So it's anyone's game. But like, if you're going to be doing something, it should be to the benefit of mankind. And that's the way I feel about it.
This is what I got out of your talk, so correct me if I'm wrong, but the analogy I think that I could make with your conclusion is that it's a little bit silly to conclude GMOs are always good or always bad. It's a little bit like a knife that's good or bad depending on how you use it. Right, so a terrorist, for example, could at least potentially create a highly pathogenic organism by genetically modifying it, right? And it's not a blanket, yes, it's always good or it's always bad. It's just, it's a tool that we can use to do good things, and let's focus on that. Is that a fair assessment?
I say that's a very fair assessment. What I really try to bring home is that science in itself, I would say that science is basically driven by two things. It's driven by good people and greedy people. And one thing about, as a researcher, I know that science is not a snappy thing. You can't just tell, you know, expect science to give you the results the next day. Science takes time. And if people force science in the direction they want it to go, to say the things that they want to say, you know, people will get hurt. And because you can't do good science that way, because you don't know all the unknowns, you don't know the dangers out there. And I really feel that, you know, if you give science the time it needs, you can really take anything that is harmful, and you can figure out the unknowns, the dangers that it is causing, and you can go do something about it. And isn't that the point? Science is about giving truth and not a desired outcome.
Amen.
Surely hybridization is just as dangerous as normal GMO stuff. I mean, like, you adding two plants randomly together. Well, not randomly, but you're allowing for random genes to cross over and the alleles to get mixed up, whatever, and little chiasms to form. And surely genetic modification is more precise than that.
That's sort of the way I feel, in a sense that there's more control. You sort of get natural genetic modification happening all the time. It's sort of how nature intended it. Things are supposed to have diversity. Things are supposed to evolve. That's the way it's nature intended, right? But things in nature aren't always that good. Like, some of the most dangerous toxins you could possibly find are natural type of thing. So how does that get carried over? And where you're having selective breeding of, you know, plants, I do think, Phil, in a sense, the EU, they say that GMOs are no more dangerous than, you know, selective breeding that way. And I do feel that it's more precise. You are spraying the plants with insecticides, so you sort of eliminate, to a large extent, natural genetic modification, which is not always beneficial to the plant, as we saw in the presentation.
Are you aware of a case where it's been demonstrated that someone deliberately modified an organism to do harm?
For instance, Fort Dendrix, I think that's where they do all the bioweapon research in the States. I know I've seen some horrific pictures of where they actually intentionally use GMOs to create havoc.
Actual biological warfare systems.
That's full-on biological warfare systems, yeah. And that is something I completely disagree with.
Yeah, of course. Whether or not the American military is modifying organisms to kill us, we still want to be able to reap the benefits of GMO, and exactly. I think that to sort of rule it out so that we don't have military doing, they're going to do it anyway.
Yeah.
So,
In terms of genetically modified crops, there seems to be a lot of public misconception about the dangers and risks involved, and you touched on some of that stuff in your talk. Would you mind running us through some of the public misconceptions that people have about GMO and whether or not perhaps that they're justified, some of their fears?
I learned a lot preparing for this talk in the sense that, you know, you think of the GMOs out there that it's proven to be safe, and when I realized that's not always the case. There's a term that is used that was approved in 1996 by the World Health Organization called substantial equivalence, where if you can prove that a GMO and its natural equivalent have the exact same amount of nutrients and that they lack the same allergens and toxins and things like that, then it's safe. And you require no extra safety testing. And that's something where I get a little bit wary. Like, you know, even if, like I was giving the analogy, if you're having bad weather, you know, you sort of know what to look for the danger signs. You look for a tornado and you're like, okay, that's danger, I can see it. But when you're working with on a molecular level where you are mixing things together and you have no idea what these two organisms and what their gene, you know, how the DNA is getting integrated, what is it producing, what kind of proteins, you don't know how to detect that. And like, there may be many unseen dangers that you don't know how to detect. And for me, I would, as a consumer, feel a lot safer if you can prove it substantially equivalent, but you could also do, for instance, independent studies. And that's what we're seeing. A lot of corporations, they'll call it their safety testing is done as an industrial study, where it's the company's researchers doing the testing. And the reason they do that is obviously to, you know, intellectual property rights. You can't just hand over your multi-billion dollar patent to some researchers and then that technology gets into the wrong, you know, it's a huge financial loss. So in a sense, I really feel that if companies are so secure, you know, in the fact that their product is safe, then they should allow for independent testing. You know, you sort of write in contracts, you can protect the IP, but we should know as consumers that at least independent studies have been done that are neutral, that aren't anti, you know, GMO, that aren't pro-GMO, but we know that it's safe.
So would you endorse the precautionary principle for GMOs? And if so the precautionary principle is that before you do X or release X onto the market, it must be shown to be safe and or effective or have desirable properties and lack certain deleterious properties, for example. That would be the precautionary principle. So would you endorse that for GMOs? And then in light of the points we've been making, though, wouldn't you have to do the same thing for non-GMO products as well? And then if it's yes to both those questions, where does the money come from?
Okay, as a scientist and a consumer, I would take the precautionary reach. You can't feed millions of people something and you don't know the unseen dangers. That is not good science and that's not good practice. I would say definitely precautionary, I think, with both things. Whatever I'm eating, if I'm paying money for it, I want to know what's in it. So you're going to tell me if there's growth hormones in it, if a non-GMO crop, and you're going to tell me if it is genetically modified, because as in the consumer protection right, that, which is a great thing in South Africa, by the 1st of October this year, everything that is GM must be labelled. So that is, we have a right to know, and that's I'm definitely going for precautionary, and I'm glad that the labelling and the awareness is out there.
Is there any evidence that we are feeding GMO crops to people on large scale without thorough precautionary testing beforehand?
One example that I can think of is BT corn. Now, that's the biggest. We have about 2.8 million hectares of BT corn in South Africa, and that is, in the States, there's an article that came out this year showing that particular, well, BT corn, should I say, is a genetically modified corn that has a natural insecticide from a bacteria growing in it. And now, through safety tests, it was shown that it's not toxic to humans. But when they did a test in the States, they saw that they tested 100 mothers that were pregnant, and they found that particular insecticide in their bloodstream as well as in the fetuses. And that's really showing that it didn't break down in the digestive tract, that it's actually making its way into the bloodstream. But I will say, however, this study could not show that it was causing birth defects, and it could not show that it was harmful to the mother. You know, and look, a lot of good points that were raised today was saying, you know, how long do you have to test to make sure something is safe? People have been eating it for 20, 25 years, and nothing's happened to them. Who's to say that nothing will happen?
That's much like medicines. A lot of the time with medicines, we test for as much as we can up front, and we put it to public once we know it's safe and that it's not going to cause crazy birth defects or terrible mortality. And then our biggest test pool is the general population who are taking aspirin on a daily basis. And we find that it actually has way more benefits than deleterious effects. And I think a lot of that has been happening with the BT corn. 100 mothers is a very small sample size. I don't know if that could be considered to be statistically significant given how small the sample is. But I'm not a scientist. You are.
I agree with you in the sense, and it was preparatory, it was a bit biased in the sense it was in Canada, when Canada is one of the, you know, biggest producers of BT corn that you can find. But the fact for me that they found it in the bloodstream is worrying. It's doing something that they said it couldn't. And that's where something like that pops, the regulation isn't tight enough, and if something like that happens and you said it couldn't, that worries me.
Out of interest, could you take us through some basic chemistry and biology to tell us how you genetically modify something?
Right, so basically when we go into the lab, it's usually a rational approach. The most important thing I think with science is outcome. Your outcome is to make something better. So genetic engineering, you would take, for instance, we're mostly used to working with bacteria because they're easier to grow in the lab. So you would take a particular cell line that is competent. You would weaken the strain, for instance, in coli, make sure that it's not going to give you some kind of disease type thing. You take a weakened strain. And I'm going to relate to what I do. I do testing for anti-malarial. So we take the parasite that causes malaria, the Plasmodium parasite, we put that gene into E. coli, we call it adamant, that protein will be expressed. We take that protein and, okay, so you basically integrate into its DNA, and then the gene will then basically code for mRNA. mRNA will then get translated into, will provide amino acids into proteins, and proteins are just the heavy workers of the cell. And we take that protein, we harvest it, and we do tests on that. We do enzyme activity assays, and that's basically how we use it in the lab. I think whatever you hear on podcasts, whatever you hear in lectures or in the newspapers, just the way I think of it is whatever you choose to believe about science, make sure that it is the product of your own conclusion. And in the sense, as a scientist, I think that science, the only thing it really is the expression of knowledge, and that knowing something cannot really be harmful. You know, not knowing something is harmful. And that's why it's really important that you use science and you listen to these things as a tool to decrease the unknowns of life. And when you can decrease the unknowns, you can make something safer. And that's the whole thing. And if the truth is that, for instance, well, this talk was about genetically modified organisms, if the truth is that your GMO isn't safe, you know, it's not the end of the world. You know, you send it back to the lab, you give it the time it needs, and you let scientists do what they can and make it safe. And if you can do that principle, all you need is time to take something harmful and turn it into something helpful. And I'd just like to thank my interviewers. Had a great time with them this evening. And yeah.
Thank you very much for joining us, Bianca, and also thank you to our guest interviewer, Brendan Rush Kelly.
So thank you to Bianca for sharing her thoughts about genetically modified organisms, and we hope her research into controlling malaria succeeds.
Indeed.
So good job.
And thank you to Brendan, our sit-in rogue, during the interview.
Yes, thanks, Brendan. And also to Tandi of the Cy Bono Discovery Center for arranging the interview for us, as always.
High five, Tandi. Nice. All right, then let's move on with our sci-fi or fiction, science fiction or fantasy quote for the week. This one comes from Good Omens by Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman, and it goes like this. God does not play dice with the universe. He plays an ineffable game of his own devising, which might be compared, from the perspective of any of the players, to being involved in an obscure and complex version of poker in a pitch dark room with blank cards for infinite stakes, with a dealer who won't tell you the rules and who smiles all the time.
That would make me nervous.
That's awesome.
Nice. Right, our announcements this week. For Joburg, we've got Skeptics in the Pub coming up on Wednesday, the 7th of September. That's starting at 7 o'clock, and it's at the Brazen Head Pub in Sandton. That's on the corner of Linden Street and Anne Crescent, and it's close to the fire station.
Our second event is in Cape Town, and it's called a Skeptically Skeptical event for skeptics, and it's on September 9th at 6:30 at A Touch of Madness, which is in Observatory, just off Main Road on Nuttall Road. Just off Lower Main. Just go to Lower Main and you'll find it.
Cool. And if the name is a little confusing for the uninitiated, it bears a striking resemblance to a Skeptics in the Pub event. If you're skeptical and you like pubs, then this would be the sort of event you might like.
All right. So that is all we have for you this week. Owen, where can people find you on the intertubial web things?
On the cybersphere, people can find me at owenswart.org.
And where can people find you in MeetSpace? What is your home address?
People cannot find me in MeetSpace.
Okay.
Yeah, no, okay. That's an intractable problem.
Angela? Where can people find you on the Intertuber webs?
I'm on Google Plus.
Nice.
Plus Angela Meaden. And my Twitter handle is also Angela Meaden. All my blogs get
detected. And Michael, where can people find you on the Intertuber webs? Well, Michael, funny if you ask. You could find me, probably the best place is just Google Plus. So search for me there and add me, unless I'm really boring and you don't want to and you prefer to add Angela or Owen. That's all we have for you this week.
All right. Thanks to our co-hosts, our special guests, and to you, the listeners. Be sure to join us again next week for more Consilience.
Listening to Consilience. Our website is consiliencecast.wordpress.com, and you can send us an email to consiliencecast@gmail.com. The music is The Optimist by Zoe Keating from freemusicarchive.org.